This is Dory Smith for Regime Change Radio, reminding you that regime change is about voting, and voting is about being informed. Today, Dar Jamail, an independent journalist from Anchorage, Alaska, joins us to talk about what he continues to see in Iraq. Dar says he went to Iraq to get the story the American media was not telling. First, this news on the international discussion taking place about Iraq. President Bush and U.S. Iraq Administrator Paul Bremer are at the U.N. trying to salvage the Iraq operation. The president will ask U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan to return to Iraq to oversee a political transition there. It remains unclear what that transition will look like, but Reuters has announced that top-level discussions are also taking place with various countries, including France, on the subject of sending troops to Iraq and signing potential reconstruction and other contracts. Japan has sent more forces into Iraq, where violence against U.S. coalition forces continue. Paul Bremer told the press last week that attacks against Americans were down, but the reality of downed helicopters, bombed Humvees, and a devastating bombing on Saturday sent a different message to the press. Americans are starting to fear that the Iraq quagmire is deepening and have expressed concern about how the war will be paid for. A Time CNN poll today, January 19th, reveals that more than three-fifths of Americans oppose the president's costly NASA program to put a human on Mars. Even among members of Bush's own Republican Party, 48% opposed the plan, against 42% who supported it. Even as the president is at the UN, there is another top-level gathering taking place in Kuwait, where international contractors have gathered to discuss billions in Iraq contracts, according to AFP. The so-called Rebuild Iraq 2004 business fair was organized by two companies, Kuwaiti International Fair Company and Saudi Riyadh Exhibition Company. On the economic front in Iraq, the exchange rate of the dollar to the new Iraqi dinar is causing an already stressed population to worry about exchange rates and whether or not they can get by on the U.S. dollars they are being given. Dar Jamail provides his insights on the impact of the shrinking dollar, the continued violence in Iraq, and new concerns about a civil war there. We're on the line with Dar Jamail. He is an independent journalist from Anchorage reporting from Iraq. Dar, you've been doing a little bit of traveling in Iraq, and your reports home have a lot of information about violence in them. It seems that the arrest of Saddam Hussein has done little to quell the violence in Iraq. Update us on how things are right now.
Well, it's the coalition, the CPA information sources say that there has been a decline in attacks, but it has not lessened the number of U.S. deaths and wounded, as well as Iraqi civilian and Iraqi police casualties. Rather than hitting patrols so much now, there's been an increase in suicide car bombs on mosques and Iraqi police stations, and there's been a dramatic increase in the helicopters being both shot at as well as shot down. So the violence hasn't necessarily decreased so much as changed forms, and the unrest is continuing to rise as well. But the resistance is basically just morphing to adapt to the different circumstances. So while there has been perhaps fewer decreases in the number of attacks on patrols, there's still just as many soldiers on a daily basis being killed and wounded.
You have been writing home quite a bit about attacks on Humvees. Tell us a little more about what's going on there.
Well, up to date, that's been the easiest target for the resistance fighters because they plant the improvised explosive devices on the sides of the road, and then they just wait for the Humvees to come by and then use remote controls a lot of the time to set them off. So it's the easiest and the safest way for them to go about their attacks. And those also being the least fortified targets, while they may have a little bit of extra armor tacked on to the sides of them, still it's not like a Bradley fighting vehicle or a full tank. So the Humvees are favorite targets with the RPGs as well as the IEDs. And throughout Baghdad, most of the patrols, that's another reason, is most of the patrols are carried out by Humvees. So it's really basically a numbers game, but those seem to be the things most often hit.
And you've been writing that the scene looks very different in Fallujah, Ramadi, Tikrit, Samarra, Baqaba, Mosul, and other smaller villages than it does in Baghdad. Are there regions that you might say America does not have a very firm hold on as far as their occupation?
Yes, without a doubt. For example, I just have a journalist friend who just returned from doing an embed up in Fallujah for a few days, and he told me that, in Fallujah, they will not do patrols through the city. They, when they go in, it's only to go in and seal off a neighborhood for a certain amount of time so that they can go in and then do house-to-house raids, and then they pull out right away as well. So it's very dangerous for the forces up there, and they can't even run a regular patrol through the city. Another statistic in Fallujah is any patrol that's out longer than 30 minutes up there gets hit. So, needless to say, they do not have a handle on the situation there. It's not quite as intense in Ramadi and Samarra and Tikrit, but maybe it's almost as bad. It's really tense up there. And even saying that they have a handle on things in Baghdad is a bit of a stretch as well, because the patrols here are still getting hit on a daily basis as well.
We've heard just recently that the Bush administration is changing its view a little bit of the transition to Iraqi self-rule, that Bremer is starting to look at a little bit of a different kind of transition. Now, is this possibly in response to what some of the imams are saying about the occupation today?
Yes, it's actually a direct result of some of the unrest in the Shia community, particularly that of Ayatollah Sistani. He has requested, Bremer put forth the initial plan, and Sistani said, no, that's we want true democratic elections, and your plan is not going to give us those. So he said, this will not work. So the CPA is scrambling at this point to try to make some concessions and try to reach some sort of compromise with Sistani, but right now it's very tense because most people believe that Sistani will not back down, and that is the vast majority of the population of Iraq is Shia and follow every word that he says. And whatever he requests his followers to do, they're going to do it. So it is a tense time. The elections are very up in the air, and how that plays out is really going to determine what happens here. That along with whether they finally begin to rebuild the infrastructure and stabilize the security situation. If all of these things don't come to pass by this summer, then it's going to make for a very, very interesting time here.
There have been some statements made about the characterization of this war right now, whether or not we're seeing a Somalia model, maybe we're looking at a Lebanon model. How would you characterize the level of difficulty that the CPA is having right now with the various groups, different Muslim groups and different populations in Iraq? Would you say that there's a targeting more of one group than another right now?
Well, the CPA is definitely targeting the Sunni. They took the Sunni from being completely in power of Iraq with the Saddam Hussein regime to even giving them a minority number of seats on the Iraqi Governing Council, as well as going in to the Sunni strongholds and doing nightly raids and detaining people and going in and increasing the number of patrols there, doing collective punishment with the water and electricity, detaining family members of people who they suspect might be involved, and then not threatening, hey, well, we will not release these people until this person we suspect to be involved turns himself in. And they're definitely being targeted. The CPA, while appearances have it that they favor the Shia, even with them, they're still trying to call the shots as far as how transparent the elections will be, how democratic they'll be. So while they're using more overt violence against the Sunni population, All of the others are really, there's lots of infighting going on. There's a big problem you probably read up in Kirkuk not too long ago with demonstrations and some people being killed and violence up there. So really, every religious group here in Iraq, there's lots of infighting. And, you know, every time I go out and speak with people, the topic of civil war usually comes up within a few minutes of the conversation.
I want to take a minute to ask you, Dar Jamail, whether or not you think that this civil war process that people are talking about is being provoked by America. That is another topic under discussion of whether or not the Americans' tactics might be provoking divisions in Iraq that didn't exist before the invasion.
It has definitely inflamed all of the existing tensions that were here before they came. You know, that's a very good topic, because when I first came here 2 months ago, I had an idea that a lot of what was going on was intentional by the Americans to keep it unstable, to sort of propagate the unrest and use that to their advantage. But over time, my opinion has changed, and today I think that was giving the Americans too much power here. From what I've seen, they're struggling to keep their nose above water. All of the infighting with the religious groups, the security situations is still really bad, and I just don't grant the CPA and what the Americans are trying to do here is having that much control. From what I see, I think the situation is simmering, quickly approaching a boiling point, and I just don't think they'd have that much control over the situation. Even just today, for example, you could get 1,420 dinars yesterday for one U.S. dollar. Today you can get 1,000. When I first got here 2 months ago, for one U.S. dollar, I could exchange it for 1,950 Iraqi dinars. And then yesterday I exchanged some money, and the rate was 1,400 Iraqi dinar. Today it is 1,000 Iraqi dinar. So a huge drop in less than 24 hours. At the same time, the cost of food, of petrol here has just continually increased over the last 2 months. Just prices for tomatoes, for example, have gone up to 75 dinars a kilo, and it's gotten out of control as far as just the cost of basic living expenses, the fuel, the benzene situation, the heating oils that people use. So this drop in the value of the dollar is going to make the daily situation for Iraqis here. People literally are being put in a position where they can't afford to put food on the table. So, and this has all just happened. I mean, the huge drop just happened. So it's going to be very interesting and very tense here over the next few days to see how this plays out. Because when you're paying an Iraqi a $60 wage a month, and then all of a sudden, the value of the dollar now, rather than buying 2,000 dinars, it's buying 1,000. What's that going to mean as far as them being able to put food on their table and gas in their car? And it's going to be very interesting to see what the CPA does to handle that, because every Iraqi I've spoken with today has said they have to step in now and do something about this. There's no way that this is going to work. People will not stand for this. So it's a very tense time, and the next few days we're going to need to watch real closely and see if the CPA does step in to try to counter this problem.
Now, you have reported in the last few days on quite a bit of Iraqi civilian death and injury at the hands of the U.S. Just yesterday, Human Rights Watch wrote a letter to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld asking that human rights and the Geneva Convention be respected better by American forces in Iraq. Have you heard about this? Are you hearing a lot about civilian casualties at the hands of the U.S. forces?
Yes, I did read that letter as well earlier yesterday, and that's going on every day. It's first off, it's the violence, a real commonality here, and I've seen this from when I first arrived here, but anytime there's an attack on a U.S. patrol, for example, they generally, most of the time, will open up firing in virtually every direction. Civilians are always hit, often killed, always wounded. So that's one instance that's always going on. Another problem is simply they're going into homes and detaining people. They're not charging them with anything, and they're just holding them. In the instances of abuse, they're really coming to the surface now. I knew when I first got here, I was hearing stories that they're going on. Now more and more I'm interviewing people personally who've been in jail, been tortured, really horrendous methods of torture, all of which are war crimes, and this is happening here on a daily basis. And so as far as the civilian casualties, the other aspect of it is that as a result of the U.S. really more heavily fortifying their bases and checkpoints and things like this, the resistance are going more after the Iraqi police. So they're going in and suicide car bombing Iraqi police stations. So that's causing a dramatic increase in the civilian deaths as well.
You have written, too, about some of what's happened to Iraqi homes and that they've been destroyed, that the U.S. forces are going in doing these search operations. Tell us more about how that is having an impact on towns that you've been in.
It's basically raising the level of anger and impatience and intolerance towards the U.S. occupation here. Because in addition of them going in and doing home raids in villages, oftentimes in entire neighborhoods, and detaining huge numbers of people in the attempt to get one or two individuals, so therefore most of the people they're detaining are innocent, oftentimes held for months at a time, and they're never told why, and there's no way for their family to contact them. And that's caused people to just become infuriated. I'll go into these towns and conduct interviews, and at times we'll just have to leave because people will become so outraged and start yelling at us. The other reason is the collective punishment. The collective punishment here being done by the Americans is going on in force. Entire towns are being, their electricity is being cut for several hours at a time. Their water's being cut. They're putting up checkpoints, making people wait hours at a time to move from point A to point B. And you go up to a town like Ramadi, Fallujah, Tikrit, or Mosul or Samarra, and people are just enraged. It's their lives have become miserable, particularly in just the last few months, and they're just really. It's only the other disturbing fact about it is many people are saying, you know, we're being left with no option other than to join the resistance because of how we're being treated. So the heavy-handed tactics, again, while it is providing the U.S. with one or two important people that they're going after, it's infuriating far more.
Again, about Paul Bremer, the so-called governor of Iraq, he has been saying, and others have been saying, that things are improving when it comes to attacks on the U.S., and it sounds from what you're saying like that's not what's happening. Can you talk a little bit more about Bremer and the way Iraqis feel about their access to him and others in the CPA?
Well, as far as access, everyone here knows they have none. Everyone here knows that the CPA they look at the CPA the same as they looked at the Saddam regime. Because the CPA, Paul Bremer, the Americans here, they have literally moved in to most of Saddam's old palaces and compounds. The Green Zone is basically in Saddam's main palace, I mean, that whole area. And they have basically just, it's out with the old, in with the new. And many people here, in fact, view them in the same way. And they have done that not only in Baghdad, but in cities throughout Iraq. They've moved in, and they're using the same heavy-handed tactics, picking people up off the streets, disappearing people. The families have no access to them, and as far as really being able to talk with them and voice complaints, they're untouchable. It's even most Iraqis are not even allowed into the CPA. Only translators, generally, if they're only even with someone of, you know, a Western person. So most people know they do not. The CPA does not represent them in any way. And more people are starting to realize that not only that, but they don't have Iraqis' best interest in mind. So they're not viewed in a positive light here at all.
You have said that there continues to be
language to the effect that the people that are in this resistance to the U.S. occupation are Baathists or thugs. Is that an accurate characterization, Dar Jamil?
There certainly are Baathist elements, and there certainly are some foreign fighters, without a doubt. But as I've written about before, it's more and more it's average Iraqi people who their brother has been killed or their brother has been detained or soldiers have come into their home and disgraced their wives and their daughters, pulling them out of bed at night, taking their hijabs off their heads, doing things like this. And Arab culture dictates, particularly when someone is killed, is revenge. And so more and more people, I mean, it's a simple logistical formula. When they go and do heavy-handed tactics, killing people, wounding people, disgracing and humiliating people, then their relatives, their family members, their friends are going to step up and start fighting against them as well. So this is what's happening, and it's just increasing with time. And more people are talking about joining the resistance, and as the temperature here in Iraq rises, so to speak, then I think we'll see the resistance continue to grow.
There have been instances recently in the past few days involving journalists, and I want you to talk a little bit about that if you feel comfortable doing so as an independent journalist in Iraq.
Yes, it's a very dangerous situation for journalists. The first and most obvious element is simply because it is a war zone. There's IEDs, there's mines in the roads, there's any time a patrol goes by, it could get hit, and if you're nearby and the soldiers open up, you could get killed. So there's all these obvious elements. The other aspect is there have been reports, even in some of the mainstream media, of journalists being threatened and bullied by occupation forces. I personally have gone up to a scene to take a photo of a Humvee that was hit, and they threatened to take my camera and break it if I took a picture. And one of the Iraqi men standing nearby said, yes, don't take pictures, because actually a journalist here about 15 minutes before you had his camera smashed. They're being threatened regularly. Even there was an AP story I read today where on a hit over near Palestine Street this past Monday, a journalist was threatened, you know, by a U.S. soldier if he was going to take a picture. So another story was there was a Knight Ridder photographer out on the Tigris River about a week ago, and he was shot at by a plainclothes CIA member, and he went up to the bank and said, hey, look, I'm an American. Why are you doing this? I'm on your side. And the CIA man said, you know, no, what are you doing for your country? You just need to know that we're watching you. So it is a tense situation for journalists, and I think many people have left, and it's not really getting any better. The bottom line is the vibe I get is the U.S. occupation forces here do not want bad press, and when they are attacked and there's American blood spilled or some of their vehicles are blown up, they don't want pictures. They don't want people seeing it. And so they're starting to use heavy-handed tactics on the press as well to try to keep that from happening. I'm aware that most people in America don't really know these specific stories of what's going on here as far as the journalists being more endangered, not only by the situation but by the occupation forces, and particularly, you know, in my opinion, even more important is the human rights situation of Iraqis. There's full-on torture going on. I've seen pictures. I've interviewed people who have been. It's going on all over the place every day in all of the prisons here in Iraq. And human rights are being violated left and right. And so it would be helpful if people would maybe write letters to their senators and Congress people and try, you know, just to express concern about that.
When you send your dispatches home and the writing that you're doing, it's going on to various websites. Would you like to share those with listeners?
Yes. The main one that I first began posting on is called electronicirac.net. And myself, there's other writers and activists here on the ground in Iraq submitting to this website. So it has on-the-ground news from those of us that are here and talking and interacting and living directly with Iraqis. It also has good news information and some actions, some ideas that people can do to try to help the situation as well. Another good site is Information Clearinghouse. It's really, really good up-to-date information on what's going on here as well. And then the third main site that I've been posting on is humanshields.org. It was started by the Human Shields Movement, and now it's basically transitioned into more of a sort of an Occupation Watch themed website. So, yeah, each of those are good to read the stories as well as look at the photos that I'm sending back home as well.
And so what listeners of this program can do right now is contact their senators, their congresspeople, let them know that we cannot tolerate attacks on journalists in war zones. We cannot tolerate reprisals against family members because one member of the family might be under investigation by U.S. military forces. There's a lot of information out there available on the details. You can look at the Human Rights Watch report released on the 13th of January, 2004. Finally, Dar Jamail, you have written home about a little bit of the good news that you were just mentioning, and it had to do with children and helping children recover from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, I went to a place called Childhood's Voice, and it's an Iraqi NGO that is basically an after-school school, an art therapy school for children. All of them have PTSD. Most of them come from very poor families, or they just find them on the street and they bring them here. And this is a very big success story for an Iraqi NGO with no U.S. funding to basically create itself and get funding through. It was started with UNICEF and now is through a Norwegian NGO. And they're doing really amazing work in helping hundreds of kids and as well as expanding. And, yeah, that has been one of the bright spots of good news that I found since I've been here.
Dar, I so look forward to hearing from you again. How long do you plan on staying in Iraq?
At this point, it looks like I'm just going to be here about another 15 days, Dori.
And so perhaps you'll update us again just prior to your leaving and let us know how things progress. Certainly keep WHUS listeners and listeners of Regime Change Radio informed about the status of the U.S. occupation and war and peace in Iraq.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Dori.
Independent journalist Dar Jamail joined us from Iraq by satellite phone. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. You can hear it online at www.whus.org. If you would like further information about this report, you can write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.